Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel and I am the editor of the TLS. This is something like the 180th podcast we've done over the last 4 years. It's quite an incredible amount and we haven't run out of things to talk about yet, have we, Thea Lenarduzzi?
I think as long as the paper keeps coming out every week, we'll be okay.
Yeah, that's probably right. And we haven't even run out of literary pets.
Although we've digressed into other
we're in all sorts of weird places now. Yeah. But they all give joy in their own way. Are you ready for some more?
Yes.
Christopher Patton gets in touch from Jakarta to confess that his dog is called Jacko after the bass player Jaco Pastorius. But the two of them go together, so Christopher and Jacko go together and on the street, they find some street cats, which he has dubbed the Baker Street Irregulars, after the boys who helped Sherlock Holmes. And his neighbours have translated the word irregular as Laskar in Bahasa Indonesia, which means paramilitary troops. Maybe these street cats are tougher than we think, he says. So that's good. Sherlock Holmes, he had me at Sherlock Holmes, really. Neville Shack recalls a live Afghan hound of his childhood called Zorba. And his favourite pastime was stretching out at night in the garden and staring hypnotised at the stars as if the celestial expanses above Kilburn were actually over Kandahar, a romantic companion. Another literary one, Chris Stewart, friend of the podcast, emails saying, this morning I was reading Hermione Lee's wonderful biography of Penelope Fitzgerald, and Lee writes that Fitzgerald's American publisher, Chris Cardiff, had named his cat Charlotte Mew after reading Fitzgerald's biography of the poet. And then he says, apparently this is a subject with a long tail.
Oh, ho, ho, ho.
Well done. Yeah, that's good. I like that. But anyway, Chris, we have an essay on Charlotte Mew coming out in the next couple of weeks. So there you go. Bonnie Mahalka, who calls herself a loyal subscriber, which is my favourite type of subscriber, says this. My contribution to the literary pets part of the weekly podcast is the family cat I grew up with, Ari. When I was a little girl, I supposed Ari was so named because he could jump high in the air and land elegantly on a perch. Only later did I learn his full name was Aristophanes, which my mother picked out because he had a fondness for birds. We've got a bit of a classical feel in our podcast today. That's a good one, isn't it? Aristophanes the cat.
Very good.
A couple more. One more. Paul Slade, who offers a three-pronged story. Back in the 70s, when I was a teenage music fan, one of my favourite writers was the Enemy's Charles Shaw Murray, who owned two cats called Rhythm and Blues, which is fine. 15 years later, I acquired two cats of my own, and I remember this, and suggested naming them Fear and Loathing in tribute to Hunter S. Thompson. This was vetoed by another member of the household who balked at the prospect of standing at the back door shouting, Fear, come in for your tea. Which is a fair point, because when I talked about calling our cat Boo, we talked about various names. I think the shouting out is a factor in all of this, isn't it? In the end, we compromised and called them Calvin and Hobbes after Bill Watterson's masterful comic strip. Watterson, of course, chose these names as what he called an inside joke for political science majors. Calvin and Hobbes, good literary name. P.S. Calvin was later renamed Schrodinger, but that's another story.
We have an email from David Streitfeld as well. He wrote to ask Since you've gone from literary pets to literary kids, could literary spouses or partners be far behind, he asks. Obviously, one doesn't name a partner,
no.
But perhaps the appeal is increased when you meet someone who instantly evokes favourable literary connotations. My wife has the name Fwong, he says, as the only female character, you can't really call her a heroine, of one of the best novels of one of the best English writers of the 20th century, that being The Quiet American by Graham Greene, of course, a name of such beauty that the author called it out in the book's dedication. So any partners with literary names might be included as well. So pets, okay. Kids and partners.
I feel this could only expand. Yeah, literary resonance in life generally. I'm always happy. Yeah, so pets, children, partners, and then your book recommendations, food. Someone else tweeted to say he's become so brainwashed by this podcast that he saw a reference to Hawaiian pizza somewhere and immediately thought of us. So if we've done nothing else over 180 episodes, we have done something to the semiotics of Hawaiian pizzas.
I'd be interested to know how they felt about it, though.
I can only think positively. but let us know, you know, books, pets, children, partners, you can tweet us at the TLS, at Stigable, at Thea_LeonardDootsy, or email me at stig.able@the-tls.co.uk. Get subscribing to the TLS this week. Use this special offer code, the-tls.co.uk/podcast offer. The best price anywhere on the internet. 6 issues for £5 or $5. Coming up on this week's show, are we living through the rise of the political strongman? It feels like it at the moment, or that phrase may itself just be a euphemism. David Bromwich will cast his eyes far and wide. How much did the ancients dream about sex? A question we've all asked at some point. Happily, Edith Hall is here to answer it. And what art do you consume in lockdown? We asked a bunch of TLS contributors and were surprised by the answers. Our own lockdown guru of the arts, Northern songstress Lucy Dallas, will talk us through them. I'm now sitting here in the corner of a living room surrounded by the clutter of a house from which 3 children and 2 adults have scarcely left in 2 months. A house that is never empty is never clean and tidy is my contribution to the new proverbs of the coronavirus period. But in any event, on my walls at the moment, I have Edward Hopper prints, which feel timely and relevant. A contemplative woman socially distancing in an automat, a couple seen through a window, immured together, lost in thought, an empty road bleached white by the sun. This week, we've asked contributors to write about the art to which they're currently turning, given that the museums and galleries remain closed. We expected accounts of virtual tours through famously august institutions, perhaps settling on a pixel-perfect reproduction of a treasured image on a screen. But that didn't happen. Chris Krauss spoke for many when she said, because I don't like being online and looking at screens any more than I have to, I missed it all, the virtual exhibitions, the online openings, the Zoom symposiums. She's ventured outside instead, despite the restrictions, and replaced art viewing with urban observation, including following the trail of the historic staircases of Los Angeles. Others have discovered solace inside. Alicia Stallins is drawn to the paintings on her walls. At a time before screens, paintings were the screens, windows on the contrary to fact or alternate universes, other landscapes, other weather. Paintings also last, and that may remind us that our situation is not immutable. The countryside awaits, this too shall pass. Very wise words. So how do we consume art in a time of viral contagion? Lucy Dallas has also commissioned a piece from the head of the Barbican, Nicholas Kenyon, who has to deal with that as a pressing existential issue. She's here with Thea and me now. Lucy, hello.
How are you doing?
Very good. Now, before we talk about all those things, I was interested because we asked all these people to talk about the visual art they've looked at, and they've all picked things in their house or on their streets. Have either of you done a virtual exhibition in the 10 weeks we've not been allowed to do actual exhibitions?
I have a little bit, but that's a bit of a cheat because I would have had to do it for work anyway. So I've done it to check things, you know, or look at paintings that people are talking about, and I've enjoyed that, but I haven't really done it outside that, I have to say.
No, I have to admit that I haven't either. I think it's taken these 10 weeks for me to get to a place where I might now consider doing it. Up till now, I've sort of just been flailing around trying to trying to keep things going in some normal way. And so now things like attending a gallery virtually seems a bit more real in a way that before it didn't.
I've not done it either. I'm just interested because I wonder, I'm sure people are doing it and it's, you know, you do get a chance to see some beautiful things. But Chris Krauss talks about the problem with screens generally. You know, screens are the blight of our lives and it's hard to consume or want to consume more.
That's exactly right. It's that sense of if a pause has been created, you know, against your will, against the will of the world, etc., you have the choice to either fight it by, you know, going and finding more and more different ways of pretending that things are normal by going to virtual galleries or whatever, or just accepting that this is something out of your control and just going back to books and trees if you're lucky enough to live near some. And that sort of thing. So that's what I've mostly been doing, and staring at my walls a lot, the things on them, not just the walls.
That's exactly what the contributors have said, isn't it, as well?
Yeah.
There's the solace of nature, which the whole world is kind of talking about and has become, you know, almost at the forefront. But also I was struck by the fact that nearly everybody talked about what they've got in their house because we're all looking at our walls all the time.
Were you surprised by that, Lucy? I honestly thought when we had this first discussion about it, people would have sort of a painting that they love and they'd be going to the virtual gallery and they'd just be looking at it. And not a single person said that. They all talked about the stuff that was on their walls or the stuff that was outside their doors.
Yeah, I was surprised by it. But, you know, what Thea was saying about Chris Krauss, everything is mediated at the moment. So I think there is quite a genuine desire for stuff that's actually there. And is not mediated. And if you, I don't know, if it's a picture you know because you've gone to see it physically, it might actually be a bit depressing just looking at a kind of small pixelated image of it. I mean, there are some good things about it. You know, some of the stuff that I've seen, you can look at it in great detail. But there's no doubt that it's different.
What's the piece of art that most intrigued you? I'm going to start with, obviously, the historic staircases of Los Angeles.
Oh, so good. Yeah.
Chris Krauss got a book saying that there are historic, presumably Art Deco-y type things. And you could do it all from her house. You could do the historic staircase walk of Los Angeles. And that's what she did. So that felt something that was pleasantly exotic and also kind of happily everyday. And that's a very nice combination, I thought.
Yeah, she also mentioned that there was a sort of drive. Wasn't there like a drive-by art exhibition, an outdoor one, which sounded like a brilliant idea to me as well?
Anything else that you liked?
I really liked Luke Sant's contribution, in part because it comes with such an interesting story. So he says, every day I look at Michael McClure's 1964 poem poster, Love, Lion, Lioness, a copy of which hangs on his living room wall. He says he's been entranced by the work for decades, since he was a teenager, and he finally purchased a print of it anyway. What follows is a story of Michael McClure, who died on May the 7th this year at the age of 87. He was one of the very last of the Beats. So, you know, he was part of the famous Gallery 6 reading in San Francisco in 55 with Allen Ginsberg when Ginsberg first performed Howl. But McClure is best known for the ditty, the Mercedes-Benz ditty, that then Janis Joplin sang some years later. But the poem itself, the poster poem, is written in Beast language, so it's all like grah and all of that. So that's the best you're going to get. And it evokes the figures of Gene Harlow anyway and William H. Bonney, otherwise known as Billy the Kid. And then from there we move on to McClure's most notorious work, which this poster sort of laid the foundation for, which was the play The Beard. And he says it stages a confrontation between the two, Billy the Kid and Gene Harlow, beginning as a sort of duel and ending in sex. For its first 2 years, nearly every performance ended with the arrest of the entire cast.
And if we can't, and
I'm a sucker for a good story.
And also, that's exactly what we lose when they close the theatres. The chance to have Billy the Kid having sex with Gene Harlow and the cast being arrested. I love a bit of Americana. That's why I have Edward Hopper everywhere in my house. What's on your walls, Lucy, dear? Do you have anything particularly art worthy?
Do you have anything on your walls? Are they just blank?
I don't know. Lucy, I imagine there'd be a lot of books, maybe a bit of bric-a-brac.
Bric-a-brac. How dare you?
Also, no books in my house, Stig.
No, no books in your... What do you have? Go on, then.
I'll tell you what I have understood, actually, about the people. I haven't got anything very particularly noteworthy on my walls, but I've felt a lack of it. And I never normally do this, for the same reason also that Luc Santé says it, that I can't afford it. So I wouldn't look for, you know, sort of art. But I found a thing, I think it was an original etching or a first print. I can't be a complete original, but it was signed by Sonia Delaunay, who's a kind of exciting 20th century Parisian based in Paris artist. And it's very, I really like her stuff.
Mm.
It's kind of abstract and it's very colourful and dynamic. And she worked in all sorts of mediums. And there was a print. And I mean, I can't afford it at the price it was, but I found myself looking at it and going, oh yeah, that's not bad. Maybe I'll get a couple of those, which is not my normal behaviour.
And so how did it end? Did you?
Well, I didn't buy it. No, I can't afford it, Thea. But I understood the, I thought I'd really like that and I'd really like to just sit and look at it.
Yeah. You have to go through that process of really, really wanting something and then years pass before you get it. We have on our walls mostly photographs. We have lots of photographs. And one of them is by Justin Partaker, who is, I think he's a British photographer, and it's reed cutters. And it was, in fact, the front cover of one of Granta magazine's special issues. I think it was in 2007 or 2008. It was their new nature writing issue. My husband was really struck by it. And then ever since then, every few years, we would email Justin Partaker and say, like, do you have any prints? And how much do they cost now? And then slowly, slowly, after probably, well, however long it is since 2008, 12 years, we worked up the kind of the courage to just take the plunge and buy this photograph, which we now see every day and wonder how we did. Have it.
Yeah, so you wore him down, basically.
Well, no, I mean, the price didn't change, sadly. We worked ourselves up. But yeah, I mean, it's all really photography. In fact, Lucy, I think you probably know, because you've been in my kitchen, this is by a friend called Danilo Parra, and it's a photograph of two women. They're in Peru, and it looks like they are dancing with each other, and the skirt of one of them is flayed out in this beautiful kind of sweeping shape. And then when you look just a little bit closer, you realise that they're fighting. One of them is taking a colossal swing. Can you remember this?
No, I don't. Because
really, most people, when they come, they can't but comment on it, because it just looks like a dance. And then it turns out it's this brutal fight. And every year, I don't know whether it might be two or three times a year, the neighbouring villages come together to basically settle their grievances and fight.
No, I think I was looking at your dog the whole time. That's my excuse. Yeah.
We better move on before Lucy has to admit to her £2,000 a week art habit acquired during lockdown.
Shush, don't tell.
Yeah. Now, let's talk about something that is very serious and we'll have to talk about, I think, more than once in the future, Lucy. You've commissioned a series about, because we're talking about settling into the new normal, the idea that things as they are now may change and we might get back a bit, but we are staring down the barrel of a long period, you would imagine, of social distancing and therefore its impact on the various art worlds.
Well, we were thinking about, there's the initial response in which in terms of arts venues and organisations, a lot of them have done these wonderful things and they've put out a lot of performances, streamed a lot of things. There are things for people to watch and listen to and read, but they're all free. So that was a way of people keeping connected. But we were thinking about what it will be like in the future, and that we would like to hear from the people who are producing the art, directing the art, curating it, managing it, all that sort of thing, the practitioners. So the piece we've kicked off with is from Nicholas Kenyon, who's a director of the Barbican Centre in London. And we started with him, I mean, not least because he's been writing for us brilliantly about music for years. He's a very valued contributor. And the Barbican is a large, international, multidisciplinary centre, which is presumably having the problem everyone else is having, you know, sort of times 10. And so it was. So it was a question. The question that I'm asking people is, what do you think it will look like? What would you like it to look like? Are there productive things that might come out of it? And is there anything that surprised you about the response or, you know, the lockdown itself? But people's thoughts and sort of rather practical ideas as well.
And the answer, and Nicholas Kenyon doesn't make this answer, but the answer can't simply be watch it online. You know, come, we'll do a new exhibition and you'll come to it online. Because as we've already discussed today, that is a channel and it's probably becoming a more valued channel and all of that. But that can't be the solution, can it?
Well, no, and that's what, and he says this in his piece, that so he mentions all this wonderful stuff that's been streamed by theatres and galleries and music venues and all of that. But that's not, that won't replace their traditional ways of making money, basically. And it can't really be expected to. And what he says in his piece, initially the response might be to think, oh, we'll get a vaccine and then it will all go back to business as usual. But he says that that's not going to be the answer. He thinks what will happen is that it will accelerate things that were already happening, which is what we've seen in the working world, I think. You know, the way suddenly everybody can work from home when we didn't think we could.
Yeah.
And he says that the role of technology was becoming increasingly vital for the arts anyway, but it's embedded within the artwork. It's not just that you do the artwork and then you stream it. So the example he gives is a production by Complicité called The Encounter. It was a one-man show, actually, but it's got a lot of audio narration in it, which is integral to the... There's an actor there and you've got to watch and see the actor, but you've also got to listen to the stories that are happening on the headphones. And it's been used for art exhibitions and all sorts of things. But yes, he says, so the technology, you can't just stream things. That's not what it is.
And what do we think is that in the most, what's the most precarious art form? Is it theatre? I mean, maybe galleries, you think you can organise them, you know, so they become smaller. One of the things that Nicholas Kenyon said, which I think is interesting, but isn't an economic argument, it's an aesthetic and cultural one, which is things need to get smaller. You're more attuned to your local community. Presumably you have fewer people attending. You have more involved experiences. But that can't come at the cost of accessibility, because that's one of the problems that elite art historically has had anyway, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think that all, I mean, it is, yes, he says that it has to be a sort of more humane approach and that you start where you are. You know, you're very much embedded in your place. That might help the economy of it. But... in terms of which ones are most at risk, I was thinking about this. I mean, I think live music, I think almost maybe anything that's not seated, even seated venues, you could potentially keep distance between people, but all gigs seem to me to be greatly at threat, and also big theatre productions. So I can see how you could manage a smaller one, but musicals, you know, the really big West End shows.
And weirdly, that gigs were the answer to the economic changes caused by streaming, weren't they? That bands couldn't make any money off Spotify, so they did tours and they made money from live. But if they're not going to make money from streaming, because the streamers, they own everything and they pay such nothing, and they can't make it from live music because they can't get people in a room together, that's a fundamental problem to basically popular music, isn't it?
I mean, it did seem to be, yeah. I mean, you know, you could, obviously you can record it and put it out, but still that question remains. If you can't go on tour, and also Nick Kenyon was saying this in his piece, it's not just musicians who go on tour. Theatre troupes go on tour, dance troupes go on tour, shows, you know, art shows go around internationally.
Stand-up comedians. I mean, stand-up comedians, they can all do podcasts, but it's hard to make a lot of money from that. You know, they will tour for a year, for 4 months of the year, and they'd make all their money that way, wouldn't they?
Yeah, and that falls under gigs in a way. You know what I mean? I mean, stuff, yeah. That's that's a bit less formal, I suppose. But we don't know what the economics are yet. Even the big venues, if you fill them by a third, that might not be economically viable. I mean, and also Nick Kenyon says what it's going to need is a sort of a whole different system of support and a sort of ecology of how the arts organisations can continue. But it will also have to be recognised that they are central to all sorts of things, you know, our well-being, our resilience, creativity, as well as, you know, making lots of money, which I think traditionally they do.
Well, they do, but the problem is, that is the answer, therefore, that Government subsidizes arts to quite a considerable extent in this country, historically, not to an outrageous extent, but to a certain extent. Are we saying that for the next 2 years, we should all expect and demand that government subsidizes art more?
I think we'll have to see what happens. I mean, I think we subsidise it a lot less than some of our European neighbours, for instance, already even. But we'll have to see what happens.
That's interesting. And just finally, if we had Nicholson Baker's technology, the Fermata, and could just pause everything for 24 hours, Lucy, and there'd be no coronavirus, and you could go to one art event, one medium of art, happily, as it was before coronavirus, what would you go to? You know, cinema, theatre, gallery, gig?
I think I would go to a theatre or a musical. Tell you what I'd do, I'd get in to see Hamilton, which I haven't managed to do yet.
To be honest, I think I might do the same thing. What would you go? Is there, would you go to this? Would you do anything? What would you do?
I would, in the afternoon. In the afternoon, I would go to the Photographer's Gallery in Soho, because I love it. I think it's four floors and they're all free, and I've never not seen something interesting and sometimes quite odd there. And then I would probably go to a small, overcrowded, quite sweaty musical establishment.
But that's cheating. You've done two. Well,
I know, I started early. I took the afternoon.
Yeah, I said 20 minutes.
For the evening. Yeah, I'd go to a restaurant in between, ideally, or maybe afterwards.
In which case, I'd get up early and do all of them.
Yeah, exactly.
We should probably leave it there, otherwise we'll just start feeling sad that that's just only happening in fantasy rather than reality.
But do you know what? Sorry, can we end on one positive note?
Go on.
I wonder whether now might be a particularly good time for people to enjoy sculpture parks, such as the Yorkshire Sculpture Park in just outside of Wakefield, because it's amazing and it's outside and there's plenty of space for everyone. I think it is currently closed, but I think that they'll probably be changing that soon. Time for sculpture parks now, I'm sure of it. And there's like James Turrell's, there's Henry Moore, there's Alfredo Jarre, there's a Damien Hirst thing on if you like that sort of thing. And it's dog friendly.
Oh, but
I suppose, yes, sculptures and street art.
Well, if we have to rely on the British weather to make sure we can continue to consume art safely and happily, then what could possibly go wrong?
Thank God for umbrellas.
Yeah. Lucy, lovely to speak to you.
Thank you.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Tell a dream, lose a reader, said Henry James, who, as you know, is a guiding light of this podcast. But is it not interesting to learn about the dreams of the ancients? Well, we can now do that thanks to a new translation of Artemidorus's treatise called The Interpretation of Dreams, written in the 2nd century AD, now translated by Martin Hammond. Edith Hall has written about it, and a book by Peter Toneman. On the same subject, we learn that, like us, people in the past dreamt about flying, birth, death, and houses. For example, unlike us, I hope, they probably dreamt a bit more about crucifixion and castration and having sex with Artemis. Sex is inevitably a key feature of the book. Sex with older men, younger men, corpses and mothers. Artemidorus was indeed an influence on Freud in that respect, as he was on Foucault too. What can we learn from all this? Edith Hall is here to tell us. Edith, hello.
Hi.
Right, let's start at the beginning, I suppose. Who was Artemidorus and why did he write this book?
Artemidorus was a professional dream interpreter who lived and worked in the second century of our era, based in what's now Western Turkey, which was then the Greek East of the Roman Empire. He was one of a very long-standing profession. There'd been professional dream interpreters back in Homer's time, you know, for 1,000 years. But he is the author of a very substantial dream interpretation manual, and it is the only surviving one of its kind. There were probably hundreds of such books in the ancient world.
And was it a manual that he was writing intended for other professionals like himself, or was it to give to members of the public so that they could sort of interpret their own dreams?
That's actually an excellent question, and I suspect that the answer is both. He addresses part of it to his own son, who's a trainee dream interpreter, because professions tended to run in families. But he often talks as though he's talking to a whole community of professionals, like how to deal with a particular kind of dream presents itself, a particular kind of customer. I think he very genuinely, and that's one of the marvellous things about these two new books, because they really get this over, I think he genuinely believed that what he was doing was socially and psychologically extremely useful. It's the seriousness and professionalism and conscientiousness that he takes this with. And in fact, he regularly rebukes, you know, what he regards as quack dream interpreters who rip people off and actually don't know what they're talking about. He does believe in this science. So he creates a manual where you can actually, if you read it from beginning to end, that you can learn an awful lot about the general theory and practice. Would be a very good way to start, but it's also sort of organized around topics so that, you know, egg dreams are all in one section. So if a client comes a patient comes in with an egg dream, you can quite soon find it in what would have been a papyrus roll, of course. So there must have been special markings and so on to enable you to find your way around it very easily. And what's so great about this new translation is that for the first time it's been properly indexed, which means that a modern user, including a sort of general public person, if they've got their hands on it, can simply look up, you know, boiled eggs or or mice or feet or stars.
Is an egg an actual thing, Edith? We'll believe anything you tell us. So is an egg dream an actual thing in the ancient world?
It totally is an actual thing in the ancient world. And actually, it's attested outside of Artemidorus. We know a lot about ancient dreams from other sources. Other writers would tell you about an individual dream they'd had or someone else. But this is the only compendious collection analysing all the sort of typical dreams as a body. Eggs feature an awful lot of the things that we would, you know, us post-Freudians expect people would dream about. I mean, not cigars, but, you know, lots of cigar symbols, an awful lot of phallic symbols, flying, giving birth, swimming, having sex, defecating, you know, all these sort of very basic animal type bodily procedures are very, very well evidenced in the book. So are actually things that Freud was fascinated by, like verbal puns and allegories and even number games. So certain types of dreams seem to be universal to us and to the Greeks living under the Roman Empire in the second century CE. However, quite a lot of the other ones have got all sorts of detail in them, you know, the equivalent of the cigars that were available in our culture that are unfamiliar to us. So we're much less likely to have a dream about a grinding stone pounding flour. We might be more likely to dream about a flour factory, that kind of thing.
The sourdough starter crowd, I imagine, are constantly dreaming about that. Is there a theory that can be, that we can assess that, oh, that was a certain way of thinking about dreams that's been subsequently disproved and discredited? Or
very definitely, and it's he lays it out with great precision. He's highly intelligent, great seriousness. All the ancients thought that dreams were about the future. That's not the first principle. It's a form of divination. So all this Freudian idea that it's about libidinal urges or about your childhood, you know, repressed unconscious, absolutely not. This is about what's going to happen in the future. So it was regarded as an absolutely invaluable source of information on that.
And who were his clients?
Oh, amazing variety. And that's the reason I first got into it, was actually writing about ancient slavery and getting, and I'm very pleased that the books mention my piece on ancient slavery.
Oh, very good. Good to hear.
Because I've always been so frustrated by the fact that we cannot get into the minds of ancient slaves. they hardly ever got to speak for themselves. So we're constantly having to read representations of them by their masters, right? What's extraordinary about this book is that he's clearly got loads and loads and loads of really lower class and even unfree customers. So think about living in quite a sizable city in a very luxurious part of Greek Asia Minor. I don't think he had slave customers from the mines or out in the awful conditions, chain gangs in the fields. But domestic servants often had incomes from all kinds of different sources. They were given for pocket money. So they would go with their dreams to him, but so would very, very, you know, he has customers of all kinds. He had slaves, especially domestic slaves who had some kind of income and independence. He had gladiators and entertainers who tended to be itinerant. And I think itinerant people who go around the different festivals performing, he would actually set up a tent himself. He would follow the festival circuit. So, because that's where people, like you might go to Madame Gypsy Rose Lee at a modern fairground. You know, you might go have your dream read in the context of an Olympic Games or something like that. But he's also got very top people, city magistrates, judges, and an awful lot of women. And it's very interesting in terms of the insights into the ancient female mind as well.
It's interesting that he does have a wide variety of clients there. And you'd think that because this is about divining the future, you'd think almost it would be a one size fits all, like the future is the future. But he does sort of tailor it depending on the person's class and predicament, doesn't he?
And that's one of the things I admire most about it. He has this very sensibly relativist sense of human happiness, that different symbols are going to mean different things in different minds and even different ethnicities. He says, for example, that we don't dream about tattoos because we don't use tattoos, but the Thracians of the Balkans often dream about tattoos because they have tattoos, okay? So there's a huge insistence on finding out as much during the consultation as you possibly can about, like a doctor, like a really good psychological doctor, about the general habits of life, conditions, fears, family situation, way of making a living, all that kind of thing. So I get the sense that one of these consultations, even if the dream, the prediction was completely subsequently proven to be false, that he thought he was doing the clients good with that half an hour talking about them.
So he wasn't a con man. He wasn't a con man.
He wasn't. And part of the point of the book is to make this as a very, very respectable professional science that takes application and learning. And he says you also just get better and better the more you do. You've got to take the basic theories, which include reading allegorically. So what might a mouse mean? You know, what might that symbolize? You have got a theory that can be transmitted, but it is absolutely useless without his word for experience, which is peira. We get, it's connected with our empirical, right? You get the information over the course of your career. And he is now a mature dream interpreter with a grown-up son who has acquired so much peira, so much experience, that he feels it incumbent upon himself to put it down. Now, he probably did also make quite a lot of money. He probably sold this papyrus he'd written to an ancient bookseller who would have many, many copies made. And just as almanacs and self-help manuals today are some of the boomiest bits of the publishing industry, it will have sold well. He will probably have made money out of it as well. But I genuinely get the sense that he was believed what he was doing was good and useful, and he was proud of his expertise and wanted to share it.
Is this a big deal, this new translation, Edith? Because it sounds to me like that it's accessible, and it might put this book in as part of the canon, the classical canon, where it deserves to be.
Absolutely, it's brilliant. There have been translations before, well, not very many. They are either eye-wateringly expensive. I mean, we're talking over three figures, you know, or really rather shoddy and unreliable, and not by people who knew their imperial Greek prose style very well, or both, right? I'm not going to name any names. This now means that you can buy one for not much more than an hour's minimum wage, in a paperback form, with the most impeccable translation. And it's, you know, you also get Peter Toneman, who doesn't translate it, but you get his extraordinarily insightful discussion and notes and introduction and so on. So it's actually a wonderful gift. You know, I would give this to everybody's interested in their dreams. You know, I would give this to a bright 16-year-old teenager as an introduction to ancient Greece and Rome.
I'd like a copy.
Yeah, I'd like a copy.
It sounds great. Yeah, it sounds like the book that you should have on your bedside table or at least somewhere on a shelf.
It is, but it's part of a whole range of, this is partly to do with the way the subject is developing. So we used to have, you know, very elite literature. That was what I was trained in, you know, Greek tragedy and epic. And you had elite historians like Livy and Thucydides. There was this extraordinary amount of technical and popular sort of instructional didactic manuals in the ancient world, of which we've got quite a few on things like farming and fishing as well. And these, at last, as much more closely involved with the real lives of ordinary, inverted commas, people in the ancient world, are getting serious attention. And that's just a historical development that's come about with developments in other academic fields like sort of new materialism and sort of soft Marxism, interest in bottom-up perspectives. I've been very much an advocate of this. That's why I always knew about these strange, used to be described as, you know, tacky, vulgar kinds of aspects of the ancient world. I've been interested in them since I was an undergraduate, but they have been very, very hard for me to share with the world because nobody done a decent and affordable translation.
And now they have.
Yes.
Well, that's good too. Just finally, Edith, we'll leave it there. Favourite dream symbol that's come out of this? Anything that's lingered in your mind as you've reread Artemidorus?
I don't know about favourite, but I like the one with the man who slave who dreamt he had three penises. and Artemidorus was thrilled. He tells us with pride, predicted that meant that he would be liberated and take the three names that he would have to take as a Roman citizen. The triple. And Artemidorus is immensely proud of this. So everybody out there who's miserable or suffering or in any kind of oppressive situation, just try and dream you've got lots of penises, I suppose.
And finally, practical advice on this podcast, Edith. If you want to change your lot in life, dream about having lots of penises.
Exactly.
That's the take-home message.
There's got to be one. Edith, what a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
And you. Goodbye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
A poll in 2017, cited by David Bromwich in his study of the rise of strongman politics in this week's TLS, revealed that among a group of European millennials asked to list their top five most important social values, less than one-third listed democracy. A similar non-attachment to the political system of constitutional democracy that most of us in the West have grown up in characterised the attitudes of the Americans surveyed the year before. Of all US government institutions, only the armed forces and the police were trusted by the majority. One wonders what such a survey would find today. In short, belief in the value of a mixed constitutional system, a democracy with checks and limitations on executive power, has, says Bromwich, ceased to be a common intuition among the citizenry of the West. And this should not come as a surprise. Despotism is neither more nor less natural than democracy. David Bromwich should know. He has reviewed 8 books on the topic for this week's piece alone, and he joins us on the line from America now to tell us more. Hello, David.
Hello.
Of course, what I want to ask you is what the hell happened, but I think I probably need to be a little bit more specific. there was a time when the tide of democracy seemed irreversible, but now it seems as though democracy is in fact in regression, or if we're lucky, that it exists as part of some kind of waxing and waning cycle. That's not an uncontroversial statement to begin with, though, so I wonder if you might paint a more detailed picture of the moment in which we find ourselves now.
One way to frame it is to recognize again that democracy had a beginning, as we understand it in modern, roughly speaking, Western terms, that is to say, as encompassing the transatlantic commercial democracies and some other countries that these habits and systems spread to. It's really a creation of the very late 18th century in theory, and of the 19th century in practice. And grave suspicions about it were shared by by writers like Tocqueville, Mill, Dicey, Lecky, many who would have been cited as, you know, prime members of the Liberal Party in Europe. And yet the sense was, can enough people in a mass suffrage democracy understand the workings of it to be the popular base for a government that is both prudent and capable of sustaining itself? And I think it's the victory of the Allies in the Second World War that left the feeling, well, this is here to stay, and it is the best of the possible systems here to stay, because the alternatives are fascism and communism. And then the fall of, let's say, world communism in 1989-90-91, with the breakup of the Soviet Empire, left an extraordinary glow of optimism, which, you know, are still very audible in the speeches of Tony Blair and Bill Clinton, and to some extent even Barack Obama. Then a new enemy appears on the horizon, radical Islam, as defined by Bush, Cheney, Blair, etc. And it's as if that's the new distraction, but democracy still somehow can be trusted to spread, because there's some internal virtue of it. That's, you know, like a dormative virtue, the virtue that is there waiting to be tapped. But it's a political system. It's a system of having a constitution, having regular elections, branches of government separate from each other and able to check and limit each other. It's complex, it requires patience, and it also requires political talent in leadership that appears with a fair regularity. And this has been one thing, I think a lot of people would say, missing in the US government for the last generation and a half or so. Waning confidence is partly due to that. It's partly due to the sense people have, correctly, money, and it's transnational money now, really runs the world and is more important than mere political power, that the people who wield power are anyway in the hands of the people who have a lot of money. So in November 2016, you had not a majority, but the necessary electoral majority, turning over power to somebody they took to be a very rich man who therefore knew the tricks of the rich and could run the country as well as anyone.
But how much of that is just froth, David? Because the characteristics you talk about there, regular elections, where the public are given an option and they exercise their right in that, they're still there in many systems, the US and the UK. And is there a certain amount of hand-wringing on the sort of failure of democracy or the waning of democracy, whereas actually that just translates as, we think we've got a particularly bad bunch of people to choose from at the moment, which is a slightly different point, isn't it?
Yeah, and that difference is very apparent in the way American voters, at least in my experience of seeing them on TV and talking to them myself, the way they will speak about their dissatisfaction. It is a huge animosity, hatred, distrust of the other side, more than considered thoughts about the system as a whole, that seems to be driving the dissatisfaction. But when it goes from hatred of or distrust of a leader like Obama, because he is seen to be a renewal of the welfare state, seen to be too globalist, too international, and seen to be too inexperienced, to distrust of Donald Trump, for a whole variety of reasons, the most obvious being that he is not a competent politician and hardly knows what the job of the presidency entails. Also his manners. He talks and acts like a reality TV brute rather than the polite leader of the country. But the distrust extends beyond that to suspicions that he is in cahoots with the Russians or in cahoots with somebody else, suspicions that haven't proved out at all. And yet this alternation of, you know, temporary trust in one person, driven mainly by huge distrust of the other side, and then a changing of sides, that seems to be a pattern now. So I don't think it amounts to people saying to themselves, democracy has failed, let's try something else. But when this pattern goes on for a generation or so, it does seem to be plausible to fear that the habits of democracy are being eroded or lost.
In fact, one of the books that sort of tells us a great deal about the current predicament is one that you mentioned by C. Wright Mills, The Power of Elite, he wrote in 1956. And that sort of shows how the culture itself is responsible for the hands in which we find ourselves, who's holding the power now.
Yes, Mills was writing in the middle of the Eisenhower era, and he suggested that power didn't reside in the hands of political office holders or even some combination of political office holders and an almost hereditary oligarchy. He saw instead elites coalescing in overlapping areas, the military, the entertainment world, politicians, among them, a kind of mixture that made people very uncertain where power actually resided. And in any case, American government being entrusted to an elite of bureaucrats, what we now call the deep state, who are responsible to, it couldn't exactly be said what. So Mills is talking there about the difficulty of determining who holds the levers of power anymore when politics as such doesn't seem in command. And that was a perception he had already when we elected this general Eisenhower, who had no real interest in politics other than being elected president because it was logically the last line on his vita, in between being supreme commander of Allied forces at the end of the Second World War and being elected president. He had been president of Columbia University. Both parties wanted him to run. So, I mean, that called into question also the definition, the characteristics of the two parties, the party system. Harry Truman told Eisenhower in 1948 that if he wanted to run then, Truman didn't care to run again. So you have this, and then, Reagan, a movie star, gets elected. Obama, extraordinarily glamorous, well-spoken, and extraordinarily unformed politician, gets elected. And now you have this showman, Donald Trump, who again is interested in perpetuating his private fortune and interested in his popularity as a media figure, but really shuffles and reshuffles his cabinet in a way that creates instability, and it's the instability that is the only constant thing in his administration.
I mean, is the other point to throw into this now, as in the last week, really, that is it a moment when all institutions will have to be structurally examined? We see in America now talking about how the police should be structured, should be funded, should even exist in a civil society. This democratic system that's been around for a long time, which seems to favor certain types of people, which seems to favor certain interests over the interests of others. Do you feel, David, we're getting to a point where these type of things will be examined intrinsically in order to create change? Or is this just another period where we look into ourselves and do nothing?
Well, I think something will come of these demonstrations and of self-examination and the actual effects of the pandemic. We don't know what they are or what affects the mass gatherings of people demonstrating against the killing of George Floyd will have on the rise or fall of the pandemic in the U.S. And I do agree that that poll which said the police is one of the two institutions trusted by most Americans may have to subtract one from that and say it's just the armed forces. But one of the things that have appalled onlookers who haven't been tracking this until now is the militarized character of American police forces. A great many police forces, including that of Minneapolis, where George Floyd was killed, received training from the Israeli Defense Forces using tactics comparable to those used on Palestinians. I mean, that's extraordinary itself, that you would go to a foreign country in a very different situation than the U.S. to get training in how to deal with street criminals and so on. Beyond that, there's the matter of order being so extravagantly connected with arms in the United States, and that the domestic police look so much like a military police now. So, I mean, I think that's going to be subject to re-examination at least. By the way, those arms, the heavy machinery, the tanks in some cases, were sold as army surplus at a discount to police forces by the administration of Barack Obama and Eric Holder. I mean, so it just shows how the habit of these connections seeps into government without any real sense of how it affects constitutional safety, to call it that, and constitutional soundness.
One of the books that you review is by Amos Barshad, No One Man Should Have All That Power. And that one seems like a particularly interesting one because it reminds us that it's not just all about one figure, one man usually around pulling the strings and again holding the power and all of that sort of thing, but it's about a team of people and quite often a Rasputin-like figure in Donald Trump's case, Sam Nunberg, the Dominic Cummings to our Boris Johnson, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean that book by Barshad, it's very readable and some of those profiles are enjoyable, but I didn't find his, I'll call it, gimmick of centering all this on Rasputin and saying there are Rasputin-like figures everywhere. I didn't find that convincing. And one reason why I'm guessing Sam Nunberg will be a name unfamiliar to most of your listeners is that he quickly disappeared. Steve Bannon has disappeared less quickly because he's a cleverer, more articulate, more resourceful sort of a propagandist and nationalist. There have been several others close to Trump, but he has not much patience for reading, for listening, for staying with any train of thought or any political advisor. It seems completely done on the basis of personality and total agreement. And right now, for example, the people who seem close to him and likely to stay are Mike Pompeo, his Secretary of State, and William Barr, his Attorney General, who's actually done more to keep Trump in office than anybody or anything else has done. But Trump turns people out very fast, and that's one of the ways he is hard to capture. And yet his own mind works on this procedure erratically.
And just finally, David, then the other constitutional point, we'll have to leave it on this point, is does a strong man like Donald Trump, does he relinquish power if there's a democratic mandate that asks him to leave? That's the specter that seems to haunt the discussions of what's going to happen over the next few months, taking us to November in the US. That if you are a strong man, if you're based on direct democracy through social media and populism, if it's a tight election, do you refuse to relinquish power?
That is a very live anxiety concerning Donald Trump, because he called into question the results even of the last election, which put him into office. He didn't believe that he'd lost by 3 million votes. He thought most of the votes, a great many of the votes in that margin, were falsely cast. He actually set up a commission, which was then quickly disbanded, to investigate the election. So he has encouraged his followers to distrust elections. And unfortunately, the Democratic Party has added to that distrust by suggesting that a Republican victory is likely to have been engineered by Vladimir Putin. That name comes up again and again as a sort of boogeyman on the Democratic side, even though evidence for it is very weak, very doubtful. But the distrust of results of elections is the sort of thing that plays into Trump's hands. And if he decides that he's lost by too small a margin to matter, or that he wants to contest an election, something that's never happened in this country, you know, will be in a situation without precedent. And I don't think anyone can prophesy what would come of that.
And on that sadly plausible note, David, we better leave it there. David Boric, thank you so much for joining us.
Good to talk to you.
That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Lucy Dallas, Edith Hall and David Bromwich. Please do make sure you're subscribing to the TLS. This issue is an absolute corker. We've got May Gray and Napoleon, not together, lockdown life in Colombia and Turkey, the history of the Clerihue and much more. And our friend Roz Deneen writes beautifully about family perspective after getting coronavirus. Next week, we'll talk about travel, given that talking about it is all we can do. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.